My name is Nick Vandewall. I'm a professor in the government department. I used to work at the Einaudi Center, and in that capacity, I've been asked to introduce our distinguished speaker today, which I'm certainly very, very happy to do. I want to welcome you all, and in particular welcome our speaker for the day, the Honorable Ambassador Kim Beazley. Let me just say a few words about the Einaudi Center for those of you for whom this coming to Einaudi events is not a regular occurrence, which we certainly want to encourage you to change in the future. The Einaudi Center was created several decades ago to stimulate and coordinate the work on campus about international affairs. The center plays an important role in sort of promoting Cornell's study and presence in the world of international affairs, and it houses a number of programs to study international affairs. It gives grants and things like that, and in addition, it has some of its own programming. In particular, the talk tonight is part of the General Foreign Policy Distinguished Speaker Series, which is part of a foreign policy initiative which the center launched about 5-6 years ago, and which is designed specifically to help contribute to debate about international events and international dynamics in this what is considered a transitional and important era in global affairs. Since the initiative was launched in 2006, the initiative has brought to campus over 30 different speakers, has sponsored a number of debates in the context of the Lund debate series, and will continue to do so. Let me just announce the following events for this fall. Jonathan Jansen, the Vice Chancellor and Rector of the University of the Free State in South Africa, will give a talk on Tuesday, October 22nd at 4:30 in this same room, entitled The Role of Higher Education in the Development of South Africa. Let me also mention that the Lund Critical Debate Series will have another debate during International Education Week on November 21st in the Sattler Auditorium. This year's theme of the debate is the case for drone strikes, which may re-become a topic of some urgency given the current debate in Washington on an intervention in Syria. This debate will feature Mary O'Connell of the University of Notre Dame Law School and Michael Lewis of Ohio Northern University. And so, again, that's on November 21st of this year. You should consult the website of the Einaudi Center for all of these events. Let me say that the Einaudi Center is very grateful for support for these different foreign policy and events. And I want to thank in particular the Sao Giacomo Charitable Foundation, Judy Biggs, and the Bartels family for making a lot of these events possible. Okay, but let me talk about our speaker today. He is, let me say that he has a reputation for frank speaking in a country which has a reputation for frank speaking. So I predict that this will be a very lively session this afternoon. The Honorable Kim Beazley is the current Australian ambassador to the United States, serving in Washington since February 2010. This is the latest in a series of appointments in a very distinguished academic and political career for Mr. Beazley. He was elected to the federal parliament in 1980 and represented the electorates of Swan and Brand at different times. He was a minister in the Hawke and Keating Labor governments in the 80s and 90s, holding at different times the portfolio of defense, finance, transport, and communications, employment, education, and training, aviation, and he was a special minister of state. He was In addition, Deputy Prime Minister in 95-96 and leader of the Australian Labor Party in opposition on two occasions in this last decade. After his retirement from politics in 2007, he did not become a lobbyist. Instead, he became the Winthrop Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Western Australia, which is, I think, a good thing to... although politics in academia are even worse than politics in the rest of us. It's probably good training, though, to be in academia. At that point, he was appointed Chancellor of the Australian National University, a position he held until December 2009. In 2009, Mr. Beasley was awarded the Companion of the Order of Australia for service to the Parliament of Australia through contributions to the development of government policies in relation to defense, international relations, and as an advocate for Indigenous people in Australia. Mr. Beasley was born in Perth. He completed a Bachelor of Arts and a Master of Arts at the University of Western Australia. He was awarded the Rhodes Scholarship in 1973 and completed a Master's in Philosophy at Oxford University. Please join me in welcoming Ambassador Beasley to Cornell.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. And you can see from that in my life, I've had difficulty keeping a job. I had to change them fairly often. You've given me a really terrific topic to talk about, and I'm grateful for it because it's our obsession. We in Australia and the Australian government have as one, there are many features of our foreign policy, but one core feature of it has been for the best part of a century to encourage the United States to engage as a priority matter in the region around us. There have been obvious national security reasons for that, and we have had some pretty close-run things in the course of our history in which the United States proved to be decisive. So it's understandable that that would be the Australian view. It's not, however, been the Australian view that we've had much success in that regard until now. And there is a fascination with my superiors that with any nuance in any position at any point of time and in any crisis situation in which the US government finds itself, any nuance which suggests in any way a lessening of American passion for the new directions that they've undertaken. So while being very supportive of the United States in Afghanistan and verbally at least in regard to recent affairs in Syria, we sort of sit there saying, not too much time, O Lord, not too much time. You need to keep yourself focused, having finally arrived at where you actually ought to be. The last few years in this regard have seen some real changes in American policy in terms of its engagement in the region that are enshrined not just in attitudes and speeches, but in actual functional activity. The United States has come into the premier regional organization in Asia in the time that I've been here. The United States has, that's the East Asian Summit. The United States has signed what is a sort of the entry point document as far as Southeast Asian politics is concerned, and that is the Treaty of Peace, Amity and Cooperation, which the Malaysians devised as a sort of litmus test for those who want to render themselves serious about Asian politics. And it's interesting because the US doesn't usually sign those sorts of agreements that have within them implicit limitations, even if not effective limitations, on the deployment of power. So it's quite a bit for an American administration to sign off on that. The United States is cooperating and operating in the region in a way which is defining the region's politics. And I'll get on and talk about that a little bit later. At the same time, there remains, because the hopes that Australia has had for American engagement in the region are not unique. There have been hopes that have been shared far less explicitly, I might say, than the Australians present them, but been shared by most of the countries in the Asia-Pacific zone. So there is, if from time to time we in Australia become fascinated with the nuance of a particular situation, imagine how they might think in Myanmar or Singapore or Malaysia or Vietnam, whatever. There's a, uh, I find my ambassadorial colleagues are often accosting me to have a discussion analysis of what various things mean. And certainly there has been in recent times an intense focus on affairs in the Middle East, in Syria, increasingly, obviously, but also in relation to trying to establish a settlement in Palestine. And that does seem to be, these seem to be enormously preoccupying tasks, and when you throw into the weapons of mass destruction in relation to Iran, it does look to many as though, well, okay, we had that focus then, but we have a different focus now, but it's not so. I do find, if I have one struggle, and I'll talk about it a bit later if I get the time, it is to get the Americans to get their narrative right on the interlinkage between the two, the interlinkage between the Middle East and Southeast Asia, because not least of the things that the United States brings to a discussion of affairs in the Asia-Pacific zone is the American engagement in the Middle East. It is an engagement which has facets of it absolutely critical to the nations of Southeast Asia and East Asia. And if the Americans weren't engaged in the Middle East, they would be far, US would be far less useful to those countries than it in fact is. But that's for a little bit further down the track. But I do need to talk about Syria. I do need to talk about those things. I can see that, and I will get to it. But first, let me just talk about the Obama administration's approach. Now, a lot of folk in the United States speculate on whether President Obama is going to be the first but only African-American politician who will take the senior magisterial job in this country. Interesting speculation. Of course there will be others as we go down the centuries of American democracy. But I'll tell you one thing he'll be the only of. Not being the only African-American politician to lead, I'll lay you London to a brick, and through my children sustain the bet that there will never be another president of the United States who speaks fluent Bahasa Indonesia. And it's going to be a factor in Obama's thinking, which I don't think a lot of Americans fully comprehend, but which many statesmen in the Asian region are genuinely fascinated with. And it's Obama's leadership which has turned the keys decisively at different points of time over the last few years to get the United States engaged in the regional organisations and then subsequently to follow up, to experiment. The US is constantly experimenting with the character of the bilateral relationships they have in Asia and the multilateral relationships that they have in Asia to try and get them right, to understand what the full dimensions of them are, to understand where there is saliency in American economic or military or people-to-people position that can be utilised usefully. The US is engaged at its senior levels intellectually at a depth far deeper than the average American would understand. And by and large, I would say doing it extremely well. Not to say that there are no mistakes, but the US is chancing its arm, and generally speaking, as it chances its arm, it does well. And the US too is chancing its arm in a way that often specialists will tell them that they should not. For example, the US treats China not as an inferior, or not as a nation that underestimates, that is, has its power underestimated. The United States is treating China now in the way in which you would have to treat China, a China that will be 20 years from now. Now, a lot of people would be critical of that and say that you create concerns, anxieties, and for different reasons in Japan and Korea, at other places while you do that. And the US say, no, you have to treat them seriously. They are a vitally important part of global politics, and it's going to be trial and error and difficult processes by which we map that out. And that could be seen most evidently on display in the recent discussions between Xi and Obama in California. A move that, you know, if you're speculating on where the United States was going with China, the type of relationship and conversation you'd expect 10, 15 years from now, not the type of conversation now. So this is the US is doing still a great deal. And if I came on to discussion, or have time to come on to discussion of force structure, even more so in the way in which the American military is now collaborating its engagement. Well, a key statement of Obama in this process was made in the Australian Parliament in November 2011. And I was privileged to be able to go back to hear him, and the Australians love President Obama. It would have been every Democrat pollster's wet dream to sit there and look. I have to say, Canberra is a very, shall we say, Anglo-Saxon town. It is chock full of people who look like the best demographic for the Conservatives in American politics. Sort of middle-aged Anglo-Saxon males and females. And there they all were, lined up on the route from the airport through to Parliament House with handmade signs, because we in Australia don't do sort of government-sponsored demonstrations. And there was a... And they were standing with their hand, "We love you. We're proud of you." And so there was a... There's an enormous affection for him. And then when he went out through Darwin, where the US Marines are going to be, or are being located at the moment, of course, he again comes to a different Australia. He comes to an Indigenous Australia. He comes to an Asian Australia. It comes to an Australia that's where the European, I might say, the traditional communities, if it's in a majority, it barely is. And as I said to one, it is very tropical, very wet, very hot. I said to Tom Donlan, as they laid a wreath at the memorial to an American warship sunk by the same Japanese fleet that bombarded Pearl Harbor. They bombarded Darwin about 2 months later. Difference with Pearl Harbor, they came back to Darwin 64 times. Pearl Harbor, they just did once. But but I said to Tom Donlan, "You know, Tom, in Australia, the further north you are, the further south you are." It's a so some. He said, "Yes." He said, I can see that." So he made a speech, and in this, the speech was a speech about American orientation to Asia in the Asian century. He put a very strong rationale down for it, and he talked about the character of American engagement, and that had a substantial security component attached to that. It's a very specific reason for that, because there is one feature of East Asian politics, or Southeast and East Asian Indo-Pacific politics, which is unique in global history. If you want to look at it in terms of global history, never has there been the simultaneous rise of a multiplicity of substantial economic powers where the boundary issues between them are not settled. There are no settled maritime boundaries in South and Southeast Asia. There are few settled land boundaries in the region. And there is, of course, no perspective or sight on this for one very substantial reason. 20 years ago, the structures of the defence forces of the various powers, reflecting their relative poverty at the time, were basically oriented towards internal policing, internal handling of insurrections and the like. Now they can afford weapons systems that have serious force projection capabilities. And as they acquire weapons systems that have serious force projection capabilities, there's more being spent on defence now in Asia than there is in Europe. And that the gap between the two is just, departure is growing exponentially. There is not quite an arms race in Asia, but it's close to it. And you can go into definition, academic definitions of what constitutes an arms race, but many features of what constitutes an arms race is replicated in the contemporary dynamics of defence planning in the Asian Pacific region. But the intervention of Obama, his use as a symbol of the the willingness of the US and Australians to accept a brigade of Marines passing through Darwin was important as not in itself, but as a signal, a signature. Now, in Australia, we didn't worry very much about that. Certainly, there were some, and there always is in Australia, critiquing, is this necessarily helping us in the best possible way vis-a-vis the Chinese? The Australian public doesn't take much notice of that. Well, after all, during World War II, there were 1 million American service personnel in Australia. The commander of the Australian Armed Forces, and they were very substantial in the Southeast Asian or South Pacific region, was an American General, MacArthur. The Australians signed, after the ANZUS Treaty, a set of agreements governing a large number of joint facilities operated in Australia, key, central to the American strategic deterrent in the Cold War and still central to American information gathering now. Now, these facilities were of themselves in their day nuclear targets. They engaged Australia in a way we never would otherwise have been in the global balance and the threat of devastation during the course of nuclear war. We doubled American early warning time. We were essential communicants with American ballistic missile submarines in particular areas of the globe, and we were quite fundamental to American understanding of Soviet weapons systems and their capabilities and their adherence to things like arms control agreements. All of this is vastly more significant than a rotation of a brigade of Marines through Darwin, and particularly when one further considers that in any one year for the last 20 or 30 years there have always been 15 to 20,000 American service personnel one way or another in Australia. So it was its symbolic significance in the context of the discussion that Obama had about East Asia that made that important, not the fact of it. And the fact of it, of course, is understood and appreciated much more intensively in Australia than elsewhere. Reactions in the region were interesting. The Chinese slow to react and then only at a middle-ranking level. But as the time's gone by, more often in a quizzical sort of way, it has featured in discussions between us and the Chinese leadership and between the United States and the Chinese leadership. The Chinese have the same ambivalence in establishing the basis of their relationship with the United States that the United States has with China. And there's an understanding that there's a risk in the Chinese mind, in some ways you might say a paranoia in the Chinese mind, that the Americans are trying one way or another to ring fence them. But the Chinese also comprehend that at the same time, there's a dependency, an interdependency between the American and the Chinese economy, and as they look out to the long distance future, their prosperity and global prosperity is dependent on them getting on with the United States. There are limitations, therefore, on the degree to which they can afford arguments with the US over a whole variety of matters, let alone American participation in affairs in the Southeast Asian region. On the other hand, because the Chinese are no different from anyone else, there can always be dissonance in foreign policy. There can be foreign policy apparently contradictory, driven in one direction by the imperatives I've just been talking about, but in another direction by PLA imperatives over secure borders. And the two things can produce dissonance in the direction of Chinese foreign policy. And it has to be said that Obama's intervention actually arrived in the middle of one of those periods in which the sort of harmonious rise component of Chinese policy making had become a little subordinate to the forward-leaning, aggressive pursuit of China-determined borders zone of thinking in the Chinese military, to in producing quite anxiety-creating circumstances in the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, in particular, but in other parts of Southeast Asia as well. So the part of the potency of the Obama initiative, the Obama effort, was not so much driven by the character of American thinking and declaration, but by the ground on which it fell, which was somewhat different ground to what it would have fallen on if it had been a speech made 5 years, 5 years earlier. So it's Chinese reactions. Reactions in Southeast Asia, well, how do we take advantage of this? What does it mean? What is the US really talking about? Are we actually going to be able to manipulate the US into serving our interests in the various quarrels and the problems that we have? What is it like dealing with the Americans? This is the question on the minds now of a multiplicity of statesmen in the immediate aftermath of Obama's speech in the Southeast Asian region. But also gestures of trust. I think you can take the opening up of Myanmar as at least a part, in part, a response to the opportunity that seemed to be being created by the way in which American policy was being directed in the region. And you've got the Filipinos now trying to get back the structure of the relationship they had that they found so oppressive of their sense of nationalism back in the 70s and 80s. They've now begun to regret what they lost at that point of time. You've got the Malaysians, very sober-minded, conservative, aristocratic type decision-making processes and presentation in Malaysia, but the slow, steady march of Najib to try to build something out of this relationship. And the Indonesians, fabulously intoxicated by the fact that Obama speaks Bahasa. And the difficult thing for all, including Chinese politicians, to get to grips with that Obama is more popular in all their countries than their own leaders are. And that probably applies to Australia as well. So that's another set of reactants to it, and the Australian reactant I've already done. On the whole, you'd have to say this, that quizzical, through to, in some policy-making circles in China, anxiety and a degree of hostility, through to an openness of mind in other places. The one thing that the US has going for it in the region that is more applicable there than just about anywhere else. Nobody hates the United States. Nobody hates Americans. They might have a variety of views, but there's nothing visceral. And that includes most particularly in Vietnam. There is nothing visceral about the attitudes of people in the region to the United States. And all of them see really, whether they argue it or not, that the American presence is legitimate, that it is historically tested, that it is economically underpinned, that it is valid in the values that they bring into the argument and valid in the concepts that they try to see directed for peace, for dispute settlement, for maritime operations in the region. The US position is agreed by the bulk of the countries in the region. Now, there's one group of people who really hated this, absolutely loathed it, were fearful of it, and concerned about the consequences, and they were all in the Middle East. There was a sense, particularly in Israel and in amongst Arab states allied to or friendly to the United States, that the US was going off the reservation. That the United States, having been endlessly bound up and tied down in the anxieties, the difficulties, the impossibilities of their local politics, was going somewhere else. And so there was enormous effort to start to try and draw the United States back to central diplomacy, to the advantage, I might say, of the possibility of sort of settlements in some areas. Not least Palestine. You've probably got, I'm not laying bets on this one, but you've probably got a slightly better chance of arriving at some sort of agreement over Palestine right now than there's been for some considerable period of time. Part of that is driven by the fact that the feeling amongst both Israeli and Arab political leaders that the United States can no longer, and their interests can no longer be taken for granted. And there is also a frustration with the Americans, and they, as they have readily engaged America in doing things in the region where hard decisions have had to be taken. The Americans now just a little bit taking a backward step and saying, you know, we do not want to be attracted into an area where we have to overcommit militarily, where we have to overcommit politically, where there are other things that need to be done globally. And I think you can see, I don't have to elaborate, we could perhaps somebody want to make a point or two about in question time, but you can absolutely see that in the attitudes of two sets of people in the current Syrian dispute in American issue in American policy making. One is the president himself. How can I keep this struggle in a framework in which America upholds values that it regards as significant globally, but not to commit American power in a way that over time becomes all-absorbing? That's Obama. If you want to see that put far more rigorously, just go to the Pentagon and read the sorts of statements being made. Because the biggest change that has occurred as a direct result of the rebalance to the Asian Pacific region is Pentagon force structure planning. And I'll say a thing or two about that and then conclude. It has been the case that I've found in the period since the changeover to the Obama personnel to the second Obama administration. There is some anxiousness has been expressed to me by by Asian ambassadors and the like. What does this really mean? Is this thing proved as likely engaging of the Americans as critics of it at the time said that it would be? What do you think the outcome of it here will be? My response to that is this. One of the things that the US brings to the table here in the Asian Pacific region is the role it plays in the Middle East. True, you would not want to see the US bogged down in a way that seriously impacted on its capacity to do things elsewhere, but you would not want the US not playing a role in the capacity to settle affairs in that zone, at least in a way that sustained some level of peace. And you would not want to do it for both cultural reasons, and you'd not want to see it happen for practical economic reasons. Firstly, cultural. The big Muslim powers are not Middle Eastern. The big Muslim powers are Asian. You could take the entire population of the Arab world and it wouldn't fit into the Indonesian population. When you move off the Indonesian population to the next biggest Muslim country in the world, it's India. And the next biggest Muslim country in the world is Pakistan. And the next biggest Muslim country in the world is Bangladesh. And their populations utterly dwarf the populations of the heartland of the Middle East where Islam emanated from. But what happens to Muslims matters to them. What happens to Muslims in the Middle East matters to them. Kirk Campbell once asked me a question, and it sticks in my mind because Kirk Campbell used to ask me a lot of questions, and I always knew when I was being asked those questions by him, he knew the answer to them. And therefore he was half testing me out. He's only ever asked me one question, I think, which he genuinely didn't know the answer to. And he said to me, your government's enormously active in Southeast and South Asia. Do they ask you questions about American policy in the Middle East? And I said, well, as far as I'm aware, never. They never raise American policy in the Middle East with us. He said, you know, it's the first point of conversation every time I meet with the Indonesians. Now, it's the first point of conversation every time I meet with the Malaysians. I said, well, they know full well that we can't do anything about anything in the Middle East. They don't expect us to. Asians are ultimately realists. But they know you can. And therefore, that the fact that you can play a role in those affairs is something of importance to some of the most significant countries in the Asian region. And all the other countries that are not dominated as by populations that are of Islamic religious background have all got big Muslim populations, starting with China, on to Thailand, onto the Philippines. There is a very, it's as a confessional issue in the Asia-Pacific region, it is a very, very important one. But even more important than these religious issues, which can be a bit ephemeral and nebulous, and change in the character of their saliency quite dramatically from time to time, there's one thing that can't, and that is what drives your economy. Currently, the Asia-Pacific zone is 70% of the Middle East oil market. In about 10 to 15 years' time, that will be about 90%. And who knows? With the way the Europeans and the Americans are going, in 30 or 40 years' time, we have nothing from the Middle East. Effectively, at least because oil's pretty fungible, but effectively in terms of measurements, ends up in the United States and Europe. But in Asia, it's critical. And there is only one power that can actually sustain the trade routes, and only one power that will ever be able to sustain the trade routes with the authority that the US now possesses, and that's the US in the future. Chinese will never get there. The Indians will never get there. They would be powerful, they'll do some useful things, but there's no one among the Asian Pacific powers with any of the projections that one can see in the weapon systems that they are developing, or the philosophies and doctrines that they are developing, that they will ever be able to play that role. The Middle East is a critical part of the US Asia Pacific narrative. Finally, and I'll finish with this, I had lots of other things I wanted to say. I wanted to go to one thing which I don't think Americans... Actually, I'll go to two things. Firstly, I'll deal with the economic component of it, just to point out why the US is never going to go off the course that it is now on. Currently, if you take the Asia-Pacific zone, currently there is within it 600 million members of the global middle class. That's 20% of the global middle class. In 15 years' time, that figure will be over 2.5 billion. That will be 60% of the global middle class. Currently, the story economically in Asia is about production and exports. In 15 years' time, the story will be about consumption and investment, not production and exports, but consumption and investment. And so from the point of view of the United States, as a massive producer of goods that are enormous demand, as people go up the consumption scale, it's going to be all your markets about 15 years from now. So the US is never going to move off that position because there's going to be no real competitor for the opportunities that are going to be presented there. Finally, military. And here is, I used to be a defence minister, so I naturally think that when people in countries discuss defence issues, that's where they're really laying out on the line what it is they really believe about themselves and the environment in which they live. And key to defence policy is force structure policy. What drives force structure? Because force structure has to be driven, partly it's driven by doctrine, the way you use armed forces, but also by an anticipation of what it is there that you must hedge against and what has to be out there that you compete with. If you look at what Secretary Hagel had to say a couple of weeks ago, before the Senate and House Armed Services Committees, that were a product of his analysis of the impact on defence of what would happen if the sequestration proposition stood and became effectively the governing feature of budgetary policy associated with the Department of Defence over the course of the next decade. And in the course of his remarks, he pointed out in that study what were the three drivers of American force structure. The first was cyber and space. Nothing particularly surprising about that. So when you look at the where will be the weight of the American development of personnel, the development of weapons systems, the development of capabilities, cyber and space, very, very big drivers. And they, of course, operate in all battlespheres, and they operate in unique battlespheres of their own. So that's understandable, cyber. Second, a bit more of a surprise, and that is special forces. Americans, of course, focus on the four forces that they have, you know, the Marines, the sailors, the airmen, and the soldiers. In fact, there's a fifth. The dimensions are so large, and that's US Special Forces. US Special Forces now number 70,000. This is a very big armed force by anybody's calculation. And that is enormous, high-capability troops, with a multiplicity of roles in a multiplicity of environments. And when you look at the budget cuts that are slated for the defence forces on the notional impact of sequestration, nothing taken off special forces. And the third driver, and this is the one that really interested me, because I would never use a geographic expression as a way of defining a force structure underpinning. I mean, I would talk responsible for production of white papers in Australia. I would talk about the maritime defence of Australia. I would talk about capacities to handle the air-sea gap. I'd talk about maritime warfare, air-sea battle, these sorts of things. And the US talks about these things. Everybody talks about these things. But in the force structure determinant laid out by Hegel, he did not talk about the air-sea battle or maritime capabilities. He said the force structure determinant is the Indo-Pacific rebalance. He explicitly used the expression, the Indo-Pacific rebalance. So that drives American considerations on what things need to be invented, what weapon systems need to be enhanced, what parts of the structure of the forces need to be sustained against cuts, and so on. So the United States has absorbed within its structure the idea of the rebalance as core to its future. No wonder General Dempsey should be, when there's a discussion about where the United States might end up in Syria, and there's a view out there that there is a set of possibilities that could be, which I don't actually agree with, but there's a set of possibilities out there that could produce another recreation of the circumstances which occurred in Iraq. Dempsey walks away from it because there's nothing in the way in which the Pentagon is now planning how to handle the environment financially that they're going to be in, one way or another, over the course of the next decade, which sees any role in the force structure for a force focused around the development of those sorts of capabilities. So what is the upshot of all of that? The upshot of all of that is I do think that the rebalance was based in the first instance on a serious restructuring of American diplomacy, an engagement with a multiplicity of functional institutions which sustain themselves in a sustained continuing American interest. It was based on a really sensible calculation of American interests, a really sensible calculation on the acceptability of American policies, values and approaches, and a sensible calculation on what ought to be drivers of American national security policy. So because of all of that, what happens around the rest of the globe is not, in fact, even if it knocks it off the editorial pages, it knocks it off even the op-ed pages, it doesn't, in fact, knock it off the way in which the the folk who are responsible for the development of policy are handling it. What it does need, I do think, and I'll make these criticisms because they're not really criticisms, they're anxiousness that points be made. I do think that it would be useful if American policymakers were to, and I know they believe these things, to actually factor it into their narrative far more effectively about the crucial interlinkage between affairs in the Middle East and affairs in the zone that we're talking about, and take it a point further to say, of course, it is the character of the sorts of roles that America can play in the Middle East that is a unique contribution to the interests of the countries in Southeast Asia, a character which nobody else can emulate. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you for a very interesting talk. I think we have about half an hour for Q&A, so I will open the floor. Please give us your name and your question.
So Australia has a minimum wage of $15.75, whereas the United States only has a minimum wage of $7.25. Why is it that you think Australia is so far ahead of the United States on this issue? To what extent do you think the United States can emulate Australia? And how critical do you think it's been in combating poverty and social inequality within Australia?
I've got to be thinking. I used to be a Labour Party leader, and we are no longer in office. And I have agreed with our successors to serve them for the remainder of my ambassadorial tour, which comes out the end of next year. Let me put it this way. It is because the division in Australian politics, the two-sided division, is not between Conservatives and Liberals. It is between Liberal Conservatives and Social Democrats, Labourists. The Labour Party in the United States, the trade unions are an important, influential pressure group. In Australia, they sit round the table of Labour governments. So the government I served first was led by the former president of the Council of Trade Unions.
My cabinet colleagues included a fellow who had also, two men who had also been president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. A good third of the cabinet ministers were former officials of the trade union movement. When we planned the restructuring and opening up of the Australian economy, we sat round a table with the trade union leaders and with businessmen and worked the thing through. It is because we have had that Labour-type component of our politics for a century that there are protective mechanisms in place. There's no such thing as a right-to-work state in Australia. You have various aspects of law and organisation which support underpinnings to sustaining life beyond on the possibility of extreme poverty. So, for example, one of the big things, though they're not really used or much these days or tended to, but they do set a bottom ballast to things, we have awards. And the awards are effective themselves minimum wages in different skills. So it's a minimum wage, but they're also, if you like, a multiplicity of minimum wages even above that. So there is I think basically I don't know how that 1575 pans out, but the way I look at it, probably the minimum wage in Australia is somewhere between $26,000 and $28,000. So if you're married to somebody on the minimum wage and you're on the minimum wage yourself, the family's up to $56,000. And if you put in other social means-tested social implements on top of that, like rent assistance, you get pretty well a situation where two minimum wage workers can raise a family of a couple of kids in relative comfort. And when they go to university, or when they go to school, they get assistance. If they're poor families, they get assistance for their kids while they're at school, and when they go to university, they receive the tertiary education allowance, which gives them not only the capacity to attend university free, but also gives them an allowance while they're at university, so they don't have to, they're not disadvantaged by an absence of funds for walk-around money on campuses. So there's there is just a whole panoply of politics in Australia that's not really classically left or right. I point this out to Republicans and Democrats here, that you can't really measure us in the same way. On social matters, the Labor Party is more conservative than the Democrats. Well, I remember this when the health legislation was up a couple of years ago. You remember there was that little group of about seven members of the House who had a problem with abortion in relation to the possibility that there might be some sort of government funding of it, and they wanted that ruled out of the health legislation. Well, in those days, I think there were about 240 Democrats in the House, and seven of them had a problem with that. If you had a similar sort of issue presented to the Australian Parliament, and the 240 Democrats were 240 Labor politicians, probably about 80 to 100 of them would have a problem with that. So there's Australia's a majority Catholic country, so the substantial proportion of the Catholic population vote Labor. So there is a sort of a tendency there to sort of some level of social conservatism, whilst there's a considerable amount of economic radicalism underpinning it. So it doesn't look like the Democratic Party. It looks different from the Democratic Party. That's a long-winded way of telling you that there's a multiplicity of ideological and legal and practical components which drive I think that the trade union membership as a proportion of the population probably twice in Australia what it is here. But I think above all, the situation of the trade union leadership inside a government, not speaking to a government, that brings about those sorts of things. Yeah. All right, sorry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for your talk. I wonder if you could say a bit more about the role of Australia in the region, and in particular about how Australia plays how it sees its role and how it plays its role in the region, and perhaps vis-a-vis the emerging role of China both in the region and internationally?
Well, Australia's focus is heavily the region. You move away from the Southeast Asian region and we tend to diminish a bit. Move away from the East Asian region, we do diminish massively. And we have a global picture in our diplomatic representation, but nothing like the intensity of engagement elsewhere that we have in Southeast Asia. I think we would probably, for example, be a bigger aid donor to Indonesia than the United States is. We are certainly in the South Pacific, if you move over the other side, I think annual American contributions to that region run at about 100 million, the Australians at 1.2 billion. So there's and then when you look at it, it's the character of it. We really think things through. So take Indonesia. The last 5 years, for example, we've built over 2,000 schools in Indonesia and trained a couple of 100,000 Indonesian teachers. And a quarter of those schools are madrasas. And we are going to build another 2,000 over the next couple of years, and a quarter of those will be madrasas. And I think the program will keep being renewed. The thing that we do is, of course, we're not Muslims, so we cannot determine the curriculum in madrasas. But what we do say to the people who we're giving money is, and we understand this is going to be for Quranic studies, but we also think you might be advantaged if your graduates have skills that are beyond just simply their literary skills and religious skills associated with that. So we train up and put into those schools centres that enable people to be trained in carpentry, trained as electricians, trained as motor mechanics, trained as panel beaters, you know, and so on. So we put into those schools trades. So the kids that come out of them, if they're frustrated by not being able to find something of a religious character that suits them, nevertheless, and there's a careful study done of the areas as to where labour shortages are, and related to the training programs that are put into each of those schools, you can be certain that the kids who come out of it get jobs. So I just cite that as one example of what we're doing in the area. Another example, we train a lot of teachers from Afghanistan, but we don't train them in Australia. We take those teachers to Malaysia, because Malaysia is a wonderful society. There's a lot of Malaysians who disagree with that, but I'll go at that. I'll have a go at that. It's got a nice, conservative, but a nice, tolerant Islamic ambience. And we want the Afghan teachers, no point in taking them to Australia, they don't get anything out of that. But we want to see them see what it's like to live in an open Islamic society in which the Quran and religious belief is taken seriously, but not in a way that means that women have to feel oppressed, or that there's that it's taken to a point of almost heresy in the way in which people are obliged to conform to some guy's idea of what was appropriate practice. Of course, you then have to get them out of Malaysia and get them back to Afghanistan. That's not easy, but it's a sort of thing we do. So we try to think through culturally what we ought to do. And then there's military alliances. We have a military alliance with Malaysia and Singapore. Australian actually commands the Malaysian air defences. This is not, in our view, an appropriate situation, but every time we try to move away from it, the Singaporeans get very anxious and insist that we stay. And when they insist that we stay, so do the Malaysians. They accept it. So we run a fair amount of the Australian Air Force through Butterworth Air Base in Malaysia, and we run Australian soldiers through Butterworth Air Base and the likes. There's a lot of these things. A lot of them are legacy things, but we do a lot of these things in the Southeast Asian region. In relation to China, you know, when they do come at us with their anxieties about our engagement with the United States, we just point to history. So you feel that you feel yourself in a position where you need to be understood in the way in which you see the world from the point of view of your historical experiences. Well, we understand that. Understand us in the same way, and that our policies are a product of things that we have experienced, and we try to understand things that you have experienced and try to, where possible, handle that. But we think that you need to look more seriously at the way in which your prosperity has been a product, and your future prosperity is a product of a rules-based international system. And that while it may not seem to have an appropriate Marxist underpinning, at the same time, it's been very appropriate for your prosperity and wealth. And perhaps you ought to give it a bit more of a go than you do. So it's an interesting conversation that we have all the time. But the point is, we have no exit strategy from the region. It is ours forever. And we either get on with it or don't. We changed our immigration policies. We used to have a White Australia policy that applied up until the 1960s. And so we don't accept European migrants. It didn't quite apply. We also accepted Lebanese and some from other areas. But basically it was. And then we just sat down as a nation and said, this is ridiculous. It's absurd in principle, and it's absurd in interest. We have to change. So now I think, looking at this on a per capita basis, not an absolute basis, but we would take migrants at about 2.5 times the rate the US does, and more than half of them are Asian. So there's just an enormous rapid build-up of what you might call the sort of Asian proportion of the Australian population. We also take, we're second only to you, again proportionately, in the numbers of refugees we take. They're mainly not from Asia. They're mainly from the Middle East and from Africa. So there's a multiculturalism in Australia which I think actually works a bit better than it does here. And it works well here, don't get me wrong. But we have, there's something about the Australian culture that nations, even with these diverse backgrounds, just slowly slide into soporific Australianism. And that's a product, I think, of us just assuming that our identity's got to be established in a framework that is compatible with the region around us.
I have a question that's very hard to this kind of understanding that I can't see things clearly as American looking into Australia. What domestic reasons are there for Australian politics in coming to bipartisan agreement on the asylum seeker issue that the right answer is punitive and only punitive and deterrent and not compassionate? And in such a way that the Labor government actually circles around and goes back to Howard's Pacific solution and has just actually shipped off at Scenario. What are the domestic reasons for that? It's not just Pauline Hanson, right?
Oh, no. It's a multiplicity of things. This is an issue which you come at from the left and the right. Okay? Come at it from the right. Well, there is an element of that you outlined in it. There is a fear. There always has been a fear in Australia that there is a penetration of the Australian moat in a way that means we lose control over what it is that we're doing. So, as part of the answer to a harder line on border protection, we've doubled our intake of refugees. So, and they fall from the areas from which these come. That's the first thing. Second thing is, we know what's on here. There is an active criminal process in the Southeast Asian area to attract people who are not refugees in any shape or form from the regions in which they're emanating, pay an airfare out to Indonesia, then get on a boat, a rickety boat, and get into Australia where they can immediately access a quite reasonable social security system and live well. And the stories are legion of refugees who come in, albeit in these terrible circumstances, and at the conclusion of it, once having established their Australian right of residence, immediately going home to this dangerous place to resolve business interests, all those sorts of things, maybe bring families out and the like. So there is an anxiety there, that is that we are being played as fools and our generosity is being impinged on. And that is damaging for us in the way in which we approach a very open migration policy, which is the policy that we actually have. Then there's the second thing, that's the humanitarian objection to it. The people who run this operation are criminals. They're vile human beings. They deliberately put people on ships, which will maybe make it to Australia, but will go nowhere else. And there have been hundreds killed. Because, I mean, the Australian Navy is being driven to requiring a post-traumatic stress disorder treatment of sailors because they cannot keep up with handling the number of people dying and drowning in front of them, coming from these sinking boats before they can make it, before they go under. And look at all these babies' bodies floating in the water and all the rest of it. And our sailors are traumatised by it. They jump in after them, try and get them, but they don't often succeed. They don't always succeed. So so the Australian Navy, which is sort of doing most huge rescue services all over the place because these people have been exploited by these unscrupulous fellows, is that when you take all these issues, it's a much more complex picture than what the rest of the world sees. So all we can do to say, look, we're not really bad guys here, we've really got a problem, and we've really got to solve this, because we cannot have this. This ain't like going across the Mediterranean, you know, a quick flip from North Africa to Italy. That isn't the waterways that we're talking about here. We're talking about really dangerous waters. We say, okay, to show that we are decent, reasonable human beings, we'll double our intake of refugees, and we are now, in terms of being a third country from refugee, as opposed to somebody immediately across the border, we are, apart from the United States, the most generous people in the world.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thank you, Ambassador, for your presentation. You touched on earlier Australia's role in dialogue with China, and it made me think of Hugh White, the strategic studies analyst from the ANU, for those of you who haven't heard of him. He released a book last year called The China Choice, and in it he mapped out a few scenarios that could unfold in the upcoming decades, and one of them was conflict between the US and China. And he went so far as to say that the principal foreign policy goal of Australia should be encouraging cooperation between China and the US. And he argued that Australia hasn't gotten anywhere close to that. Wanting to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I trained you. And he worked for me when I was Defence Minister, and his trajectory was up from that point on. And the thing with him is the point that you make about major Australian interests seeing that China and the US get on. Absolutely, that is a major Australian interest. That is a facet of our diplomacy. I'm pleased to say it's also a facet of American diplomacy and a facet of Chinese diplomacy. And we want to... We're not looking at ring-fencing China. We're not looking at a situation where China is somehow excluded from the character of global politics. Far from it. We want integration. We understand the Chinese are critical to the global economy, they're important to our economy, and so on. So, I think Hugh's pushing against an open door on that one, in terms of of Australian strategy. I also think, and I'll be putting on a lunch for him in a couple of weeks from now, so I'll be able to tell him again to his face. But I also think he grossly underestimates American power. Now, that's not to say that sequestration is not likely to impact on this. It could well do so. But I would say this, as somebody who follows these things pretty closely, that the gap between American military capabilities and Chinese, and anyone else's for that matter, not just Chinese, but anyone else's capabilities over the last decade has grown. The Americans in capacity are more powerful vis-a-vis other people's armed forces now, including China's, than they were 10 years ago. And I haven't yet seen evidence of the sort of drift that Hugh indicates in American military capabilities. Now, as I said, sequestration might impact on that, but as I look at what Secretary Hagel and Dempsey, General Dempsey, are trying to do with American force structure, if they succeed with that, it's not going to be an issue. Yes, it is possible the things which happen in North Korea could produce a clash. It is possible that things that happen in the South China Seas could too. So that's why it is very important that when we look at the diplomacy associated with those areas, we look at it in a way that ensures that ultimately these issues are resolved legally and by agreement and not by force of arms. They won't actually ever be resolved by force of arms, frankly. if force of arms, if arms interchanges take place, all that does is set the conditions of the next time it will. You know, once you get into the habit of resolving something by force of arms in that sort of region, it will always be resolved by force of arms. So I think I disagree with elements of Hugh's analysis of the trajectories and the capacities of the armed forces of the two countries. But I don't think there's anyone who seriously disagrees with the political objectives in what ought to be the a major aim of Australian foreign policy.
Phil in the back.
Thank you, Ambassador. Phil McMichael, Adelaide. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the Trans-Pacific partnership that's currently in formation, and in particular Australia's role in that process and what kind of interests Australia has in it.
We got the lion's share of what we're going to get out of relationships with the United States and opening up the economy, access to the US economy, all of that, investment, ease of investment and the like. We got the lion's share out of that, out of the TPA, the FTA, the free trade agreement that we signed with the Americans in 2005. So the TPP is not a big leg up for Australia. It is potentially quite critical in the character of American relationships with a number of countries. It could actually provide a vehicle for liberalisation of Japanese policy. It will certainly provide a changed economic relationship between the US and another rising power, Vietnam. And it's likely to set a pattern of relationships that's a really modern trade agreement with a lot of behind-the-borders stuff dealing with new technologies in business and supply chains and the like, that really will be an exemplary agreement. And then if you get it signed, then anyone else who wants to come into it has to come into it on the basis that has been agreed. They can't reopen it. But coming in it on the basis that has been agreed, of course, allows them to reform their own economies. Abe is using it as a mechanism for reforming the Japanese economy. Which might slow things a bit. But the Americans are really hard charging on this. I don't think our fellas would have started with any sort of optimism that we'd be at a conclusion anytime soon. But the Americans are twisting arms all over the place, not in an unpleasant way, trying to get this darn thing through by the end of the year. There's a bit of a lesson here. A lot of countries have thought they could take a piece out of the global rules-based system and exploit it for what it's worth and then move away from it. And those countries have made sure that the WTO Doha round has failed, basically. Though we always try to revive it and maybe can harvest a few things from it, but that's where they've left it. So what are the Americans doing? They're negotiating TPP, they're negotiating a similar agreement with the EU. Now, you put those two together and guess what? You've got 65% of the global economy. And guess the one common factor in that 65% of the global economy? It's the US. So this is a... I was very interested when the Chinese came across to see Obama. The Chinese view and the way they presented themselves about the TPP was very different. The Chinese at its outset started talking about this as part of ring fencing China and all that sort of stuff. Now the Chinese didn't do that this time. They started to talk seriously about what it would mean to join it. Of course, the regulatory environment the Chinese operate in domestically and the character of the Chinese domestic economy is a million miles from the sorts of things being talked about in regard to the TPP. But it's not inconceivable if it succeeds at some point of time that it could become a factor in Chinese liberalisation as well.
Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for a fabulous presentation. In brief, as an Australian-American, having brought in capital gains tax and getting rid of guns following on from Paul Barber, and also relevant to your reply to the first person today, my feeling is that the Australian political spectrum fits fairly well within the democratic spectrum, and I wondered if you agree with that and whether the change of government can change that.
Well, most of my life, the character of partisan politics in the United States and Australia would see, I would argue, in fact, that the Americans have been far more bipartisan than we have. Being part of a Westminster system, partisanship is structural. It is the system operates on the basis of partisanship. It's a presidential system, separation of powers. The American system doesn't work unless there's bipartisanship in the legislature. And the political process tended to respond to those instrumental drivers. But now I'm surprised. I would say that the centre of the Congressional Democratic Party is to the left of the caucus of the Australian Labor Party, and the centre of the Republican Party is to the right of the Liberal Party caucus. Now, that's never been the case. It's interesting. I had a group of Republican congressmen round for dinner the other night, and they were talking about the Liberal Party, and they saw themselves as the equivalent in relation to it. And they said, well, what is the Liberal Party like? And I said, well, okay, this is how I'd describe it. Firstly, there's no equivalent of the Republican radicals. There's no equivalent in there of essentially sort of Confederate Tea Party type philosophies that underpin the radical wing of the Republican Party here. There are people like the Conservatives, like Boehner and McConnell and Cantor and the like. There's that. And that's probably about 50% of them. Then there's, I'm talking about a caucus here, there's about 25%, which are just guys and gals, you know. They're retail politicians. They've ended up on the conservative side in politics. They do the best they can for their constituencies, and they don't care very much about people's ideas. Well, then I said, then 25% of them are liberals. Oh, no, that wouldn't apply. Well, they're liberal. No, they're liberals. And they said, well, define liberals in this context. Well, they believe in choice on abortion, and therefore gay marriage. And, you could say, they're in a conservative party? Yes, that's a quarter of them. So basically there is no radical right in the Liberal Party, and there is a genuine liberal but minority faction in the Liberal Party. So I think the other thing that's critical in Australia that's different from here, and that is compulsory attendance at the polls. Now, we in the Labor Party, I used to use American pollsters all the time because they're better than anyone else. They're great slices and dices of electorates, but you sort of have to re-educate them for a week or two before you turn them loose in Australia. Because the people who determine the outcome of elections in Australia are the people who don't vote in the United States. And they have to get to grips with people whom they never bother with. And you don't have to bother about, one of the great American figures is to establish, in polling, is to establish the likely level of turnout from declared supporters. We can give you an answer straight away. We don't need a poll. 100%. It doesn't matter what election is, it'll be 100% who turn out from the party's two supporters, which dramatically reduces the expenses of your campaign. But also, says the thing that I say that because the Conservatives get really uptight about this, I said, look, don't worry. Conservatives usually win in Australia in the same way that Conservatives usually win here. That's not the point. People are naturally conservative. The difference is this. The centre is to the left. So that means that the Conservatives are operating on a different set of precepts and principles in Australia from the way in which they operate here. So that gets a little bit closer to your answer. But nevertheless, having said all that, most of the Liberals in Australia really do feel a sense of identity with the Republicans here and the Labor Party with the Democrats, even though close analysis puts a lot of warts on that type of assumption.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Rich Burkhauser, I spent 6 months here at Cornell and 6 months at the University of Melbourne. So I would pose your question on the minimum wage and this question here, but let me ask you a little bit about the Labor Party, because they're the group that mystified me. In 1987, they were in power, and they reduced, effectively ended corporate income tax, reduced the taxes on dividends, and lowered high marginal tax rates more than the Reagan administration did between 86 and 88. Mm. How could that have ever happened?
Look, we have a very different view. I mean, I was in the Hawke government at the time when things like that were done. And I was on occasion on what we call our Expenditure Review Committee, which is was actually the committee which drove economic change. I was Defence Minister at the time, and I had to preside over privatisation of Australian defence industries, which now doubled employment, by the way. We had a recession from 1982 to 84, and Hawke just sat down with us and said, listen, our manufacturing industry is simply collapsing. It simply cannot survive in the economic environment in which we operate. What we have to do is to change completely. We've got to eliminate all tariffs. We've got to float the currency. We've got to do everything that free enterprise agenda suggests. The difference is this. We'll do it in consultation with the labour movement. So we will sit down, we will do one more centralised thing and then open that too. We will impose a wage freeze for 3 years through the centralised wage fixing process, the purpose of which will be to lift the profit share of Australian business by 15 to 20%. And we'll simultaneously introduce tax cuts and tax concessions that allow businesses to restructure and keep on going. And we said, in return for this, we'll introduce a social wage. So we massively cut each of the levels of the taxation system to give the ordinary worker the sort of money he would have got if he was getting some sort of wage rise. We walked back from that. We'd introduce universal health care so that that there's no burden on business from health care, but it's basically carried by the government. We put in place a whole range of education reforms that gave a much larger number of people access to tertiary education. We commissioned a mountain of training programs to retrain workers who were in industries that were disabled, effectively as a result for them being opened up rapidly to the blast of competition. And it was basically directed by an agreement with the trade union movement. So that's what they wouldn't make all those changes. When the great financial crisis that we've just been through started off, there were no Australian banks in the top 100. Now there are four in the top 12. And the reason for that was quite interesting. I was finance minister later, subsequent to this period, and I was responsible for further deregulation. And I sat the Prime Minister, Paul Keating, down and said, now listen, mate, you've done all these other things. We're in a situation now where you're not allowing these banks to amalgamate. You're not allowing them to be globally competitive. You're keeping them quite deliberately small by the prohibitions you've put on their capacity to buy each other and some of the limitations you put on their operations and other outfits that they buy. So why don't we take the step further? They're all howling for it. Why don't we take the step further and allow them to do that? And Paul looked at me, and he'd been the architect of a lot of what you're talking about. And he said, listen, mate, he says, listen, if we allow these bastards to amalgamate, they'll be more powerful than us. That's not acceptable. So what that meant was that the Australian banks did not go through all those innovative products in order to do takeovers and all that sort of thing. So they survived the global recession and did quite well because they weren't too big to fail they were just big enough to succeed. And it basically, we didn't have any choice. We're 23 million people in a country the size of the continental United States. We survive globally. We can't survive nationally. And we can't in any way, not just economically. We can't survive nationally in population terms. I think 9% of Americans are born overseas. 25% of Australians are born overseas. Australians are just, people are just pouring into Australia. More and more and more of them, from everywhere. The whole character of Australian culture and society is changing. But since 1991, the Australian economy, under all these changes, has more than doubled. And therefore, there's sort of huge opportunities that emerge from all of this. But we do try to keep a handle on it in a way that ensures people do not feel that they've fallen between the cracks and that they're being treated unjustly.
Fair go.
Fair go. And the other thing too is we do all this from the same percentage of the GDP in public sector outlays that the US has, about 25% of GDP. The difference between us and the US is we means test and assets test to blazes. If you've got reasonable levels of income, you don't get things, and including on retirement.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Please join me in thanking Matthew.